Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there. Trump calls for a bloodbath, or does he? Fannie Willis prevails in her disqualification hearing, or does she? We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, Noah Rothman, and Phil Klein. You are, of course, listening to a National View podcast. Our sponsor this episode is Made in Cookware. More about them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, by the way, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So, Noah, speaking of things that were said, we have this ongoing firestorm over this bloodbath comment from Donald Trump at an Ohio rally last weekend. Still going. People are still writing about this. There's a war over its meaning and whether it was taken out of context. Trump was talking about Chinese cars being manufactured in Mexico and the possibility that they could be sold cheaply here in the United States, and promised to impose 100% tariffs on these cars, and said if he's not elected, it's going to be a bloodbath. I think pretty clearly referring to what would happen to the car makers in the United States. And he says that's not the least of it. And I think it's just a way of saying things would be really terrible if Joe Biden is elected again, but it's being interpreted as a promise of another January 6th. What do you make of it?
I think, as you outlined there, based on the reaction from people who commit themselves to parsing Donald Trump's comments over the weekend, which I did not. I was blessedly offline all weekend and just kind of tuned into this. So I dipped my toe back in on Sunday evening and had no idea what anybody was talking about. The actual clip of what he said, the remarks of what he said, were just drowned out by the reaction to them, which was level 11 excited energy on both sides of the question. And like you say, it seemed pretty obvious that what he was referring to was the car market, but then he leaves a little bit of ambiguity in there, just enough to give everybody what they want, which is to perform exegesis on what he says and find whatever rationale they had previously taken into and analyzing his remarks and find justification for them. There are plenty of people who get really jazzed by this dynamic. People on the left who think he's speaking in sort of coded terms to his more unhinged followers, which I don't think can be necessarily dismissed outright. There was a time when we all kind of agreed that toning down political rhetoric was just a matter of civic hygiene, because there are people out there who interpret remarks like these in ways that give them a permission structure, license to do what their worst instincts would compel them to do otherwise. And then there's people on the other side of the question who get very, very excited to defend Donald Trump against a media and its a media culture and its tendency to analyze what Donald Trump says with a lot of hyperbole and imply that his very worst instincts are on display, even though it takes a certain amount of education to decode and decipher them. I find it all just profoundly exhausting, not the least of which because a lot of what he said in his speech deserves to be parsed, in that rally speech, deserves to be parsed. Both the policy that he was recommending along around the bloodbath remarks, 100% tariff on the import of Chinese cars, is something we should be talking about. The press is getting all head up today, having spent the last, 48 hours analyzing the bloodbath remarks and devoting a lot of attention to what Trump said began this rally and has become some stock remarks on his behalf. Defending the January 6th rioters and creating a martyrology around them. And all that stuff is of vastly more value, I think, to American consumers of political media, American political consumers of that media and potential voters, than these bloodbath remarks, which have just taken up so much oxygen and really have very little relevance to our current pertaining political circumstances.
Yeah, Phil, it really feels like 2015 again, when people are paying attention to his rallies and posts again in a way that they hadn't before, which was predictable and predicted by people on this very podcast. But this argument about the meaning of his various remarks takes us right back to 2015. This is also an old play by the media and the left, where the right or hate figures on the right just aren't allowed to use martial or bloody metaphors. We had the most shameful example of this was when Sarah Palin was held responsible for the shooting of that Arizona congresswoman because she had targets in it. You know, these are targets in the House races this year, and there'd been one in Arizona. And I think, you know, to Noah's point, I don't think you need to do bloodbath. I don't think you need to do animals, which he called illegal immigrants, but illegal immigrants that might come here from Venezuela. He specifically referred to MS-13, hypothetical MS-13 members who are in jail for a very long time in Venezuela, and said they might not be people. And I imagine if such people do exist, and if we knew the crimes they had committed, people wouldn't be so uncomfortable with him calling such people animals. But the really thing you just need to focus on is what is unambiguous, which is the celebration and the martyrology, as Noah puts it, of the January 6th rioters, and calling them hostages, which is now an increasingly accepted usage on the right, is just scandalous.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's happening here is from the left-wing perspective, this is sort of a fake but accurate story that after January, you know, after the 2020 election, we did have the violence of January 6th. There are reasons to fear that if Trump loses again, that there'll be another violent incident, or perhaps many violent incidents. So then they figure, oh, well, clearly, you know, Trump has incited violence before, so we can just ignore all of the context and just say, oh, aha, he warned of a bloodbath if we get elected, and we're just, you know, if he loses, and we're just going to run with that because it fits this broader narrative. What they still stunningly have not realized is that all of this plays right in the hands of Trump, because it allows him to say, aha, see, you were lying about what I said, what everyone could clearly hear that I said. It was obvious that it was about the auto industry. And so it allows him to basically portray all of these warnings about him as just media lies. And at the same time, it's unclear who they really think that they're winning over at this point, because anyone who is really worried about a repeat of January 6th, of what it would mean for Trump to win or to lose, or everything surrounding Trump and the threat to democracy and so forth, those people are going to vote for Biden, or they've already made the calculation that Biden's so bad that they'd rather go back to Trump, warts and all. I think that it's kind of baked in one way or another, whether you think, you know, Trump is sort of a dangerous person who says, all sorts of unhelpful things and incites people to violence and so forth. I feel like those people you're not really going to win over a lot of those people, but you're, to the extent that there are people in the middle, by playing stuff up that's obviously false and easily debunked, it just helps Trump say, look, this is what I'm saying. These people are corrupt. They're liars. They just want to lie about me. And then even if you're telling something right about what he's, I mean, every day he said something. Just yesterday he was saying how Jews who don't vote for me hate their religion. I mean, that's a disgusting, disgraceful comment. It's not the first time that, you know, I call it his sort of, you know, disloyal Jews rant. Like, it's taken a number of different forms over the years. It's completely disgusting to say that. And to the extent that there are Jewish voters who are maybe considering him, it's sort of a reminder why they don't want to vote for him. So there's plenty of things that Trump says that you don't have to distort that you could take objection to. So why the media constantly jumps on these cases where, you know, it takes in 30 seconds, any intellectually honest person could say that they're not, you know, he didn't say what they're claiming. It's just incredible that we're into sort of what, almost year nine of the Trump era in politics, and they still haven't learned their lesson.
Yeah. It's just amazing. Also, it's almost as though it's impossible to truthfully criticize Trump. What you think would be the issue if there's someone who never said anything controversial, so then you'd have to look for non-controversial things and distort them to make them controversial. But Trump is giving people all sorts of legitimate material, but they still can't help themselves just going too far. And Charlie, I was talking with a friend about this yesterday, to Phil's political point. I just wonder, you know, there's in this election fight, there's significant new information about Joe Biden we didn't have in 2020, or at least not everyone had, which is that he's incompetent, he's been a bad president, and he's now way, way, way too old for this. Whereas, you know, Trump says crazy, obnoxious things and was responsible in some sense for January 6th is not new information. It might be important information. He might be reminding people of it every day in a way that's not helpful for himself, but it's not new. Where there has been new information that's been brought to bear about Biden.
I think that's right. What I am more interested in than the likely political ramifications, although I do agree with you, they probably militate in Trump's direction, is that this is yet another example of Trump's mere existence within our political field corrupting both sides. The effect Trump has had on conservatism and the Republican Party is well documented. Less commonly admitted, for obvious reasons, is what Trump has done to people who describe themselves as liberals. The soul of liberalism, with a small L, is discretion. Liberalism requires us as a culture to evaluate cases individually and to follow the evidence where it leads, irrespective of what we might think of the people involved more generally. This has gone out of the window in the age of Trump. Trump has said a lot of bad things. I've written about those bad things. Last year, he said, and I quote, "Do you throw the presidential election result of 2020 out and declare the rightful winner, or do you have a new election? A massive fraud of this type and magnitude allows for the termination of all rules, regulations, and articles, even those found in the Constitution." Trump actually said that. He's running for office. He would have to take an oath to that Constitution. It matters that he said that. And the people who pretended that he didn't say it or didn't mean it are frivolous or worse. But he didn't say this. He didn't say, without any context, that there'd be a bloodbath if he lost. This was not one of the bad things that Trump said. And that matters. Too many people in our political world and our journalistic world are terrified that if they evaluate the truth about Donald Trump fairly, they will be accused of being on the wrong team. This is tribalism. This is what we are supposed to avoid in the West. It's extremely dangerous. The moment you say that person is the sort of person who might say bad things, therefore they did. Or worse, in the case of Senator Schatz of Hawaii, therefore I want the media to tell everyone he did, you've given up. There's no material difference between that and saying, because this person is the sort of person who might commit crimes or has committed crimes, they must be guilty of everything they've been accused of. Well, often they're not. I think the American left and the American right ought to think long and hard about whether they want to lose all of their good tendencies, traits, habits, because Donald Trump is around. And on the martial language point, that's the only way you can get here, isn't it? Is to say, well, look at that word, bloodbath, is quite aggressive. But loads of the words that we use in politics are aggressive when you take them out of context. Attack, campaign, rout, even landslide, it's slightly different. It's not martial, but it's not pleasant. We do it in sports as well. Watch a football game and just think about the descriptions. They could have come straight out of D-Day. Mm-hmm. It is ridiculous to look at anyone, Republican, Democrat, Trump, Biden, and say because they are using language that is usually reserved to war, they are therefore crossing a line. No, the reason we use those words is because our political system, our peaceful democratic system, is the stand-in for what historically would have been resolved by war. In the 13th, 14th, 15th century in England, there were actual campaigns, and the guy who won became king. Now we extrapolate out, we abstract out. So I find this just profoundly annoying, but I also find it alarming in that the habits that are being created in this peculiar moment in our history may outlive it. And if they do, then we will not just have had to live through 9 years of this silliness. We may have to live through more.
Noah, next question to you. If Donald Trump loses in November, January 6th, and his celebration of that day will be a big reason why, yes or no?
Well, it will be a reason why. Whether it's a big reason will be something we would have to determine at the time, but it will be the culmination of a successful effort on the part of the Biden campaign to remind voters of what they didn't like about the Trump presidency in the first place. As you've written, Rich, there is a sense of Trump nostalgia out there because of the material conditions that we're living through under the Biden years, which were relatively better for most American voters as they perceive it, as they tell pollsters. What they didn't like about the Trump era was everything having to do with Trump, the man, the personality, this dominating figure in our culture and our politics. And the fact that you really kind of had to be up on whatever he said in the whatever the moment was. And that hasn't changed at all, because whatever he says in the moment defines what the Republican Party believes. They're not guided by a set of principles, overriding principles, a suite of policy issues that are codified in a platform. They're guided by whatever Donald Trump says in the moment. And so being up on whatever he says in the moment is an act of civic hygiene that you have to participate in if you're a participant in our civic process. And that's exhausting. And it's kind of irritating. And he has a tendency to do this sort of thing. So while I understand the criticisms of the Biden administration, the Biden campaign's effort to remind voters on a semi-regular basis of all the frivolous stuff that we talked about and argued about over the course of those 4 years, none of which mattered very much, it might culminate in what you're describing as their pathway to victory, which is just to restore this sense of among voters that was prevalent in 2020 of exhaustion with everything about Donald Trump, the man.
Yeah, I think another reason, Noah, by the way, that there's Trump nostalgia is the pandemic has basically been forgotten. And I was looking back at some exit polls in 2020, and I myself have forgotten what a big issue the pandemic was. It was a real voting issue. You know, how seriously you took it, how you think Trump had handled it, made a big difference.
And you could foresee, as we foresaw, and anybody who read books about the Spanish flu, for example, or the Hong Kong flu in the 50s, that the natural instinct is to push that all deep into the recesses of your memory and move mm-hmm. past it. Nobody likes to dwell yeah. upon what we had to right. do to get through the pain.
Yeah, who wants to keep thinking about that, even though we are going to have a segment about it in a minute. But yeah, as people are evaluating Trump's administration on the first 3 years and are giving him a pass on the pandemic, which did not happen in the middle of the pandemic in 2020. Phil, January 6th will be a big factor if Trump loses.
I think it will be a factor. I think, let's keep in mind that he lost the first time. And I think that he lost for a whole variety of reasons that were ultimately tied up to him never really rising to the level of being sort of presidential. He still was always like Trump and acted like Trump. And never sort of put the whole shtick behind him when he became president. And all of that was confirmed. Basically, all of the reasons he was voted out was confirmed on January 6th and by what happened on January 6th. The problem for Biden is that his presidency sort of confirmed most of the anti-Biden arguments. So we'll see how that sort of sorts out. But I'd say that if Trump loses, January 6th will be one strong piece of a broader argument that we can't trust this person with power again.
So, Charlie, we have two A factors, but not necessarily a big factor on the board.
I think if he loses, it will be the main reason, at least as a stand-in for his general election denialism, lies, desire to hijack the Constitution and Electoral Count Act. I think this is a big problem for him in the suburbs, and I don't know if he can overcome it. And if he can't, it will probably be the difference.
So I'm going to go with Noah and Phil, a reason standing in for just the whole temperament issue. I think this is the one presidential quality where Biden is still ahead of Trump, and it has to do obviously with a lot of misgivings about Trump. So I think it'll be a reason. I was beginning to look full around with the electoral map just yesterday, and I got to say, the path for Trump, it's right there. You know, it's win Georgia and Arizona. He's ahead in Georgia. I think he's going to win Georgia. I don't know about Arizona. They're very confident about Arizona, but who knows? And then just pick off one of those former blue wall states, and he's pretty handily ahead in Michigan at the moment. A long way to go, but you can see the electoral path there. So with that, let's hear from our sponsor this episode, Made In Cookware. If you're considering the pros and cons of different cookware brands, you should know that Made In has more of the pros. Pros like Tom Colicchio, Nancy Silverton, Brooke Williamson, and many other professional chefs who all trust their cooking to Made In Cookware. Fact is, Made In has a long-standing relationship with professional chefs. The company evolved from a 100-year-old kitchen supply business and works with multi-generational makers to craft each piece. They make exactly what demanding chefs are looking for, including a wide selection of curated products from carbon steel to stainless clad, plus plateware, glassware, and much more. But perhaps the biggest pro is that Made In is sold online and delivered to your door, all for a fraction of the price of other top brands. If you want to take your cooking to the next level, invest in Made In Cookware. Once you try it, you'll be pro Made In too. Now, right now, editors, listeners, get 10% off full pressed items from Made In. For full details, visit madeincookware.com/editors. That's M-A-D-E-I-N cookware.com/editors. We have Made In Cookware here in the Lowry household, and it really is tremendous stuff. It actually gives me pleasure. I'm not making this up. Gives me pleasure every time I use a Made In pan. It just feels so good in your hand. It's just well-crafted, cooks well, and very importantly, is easy to clean. So Phil, we had a big story in the New York Times, speaking of the pandemic, that ran through all the research that now has been done in retrospect about the effect of school closings, and it is exactly the debacle you would have expected, the debacle we've heard about in various research up to this point. But this piece is another inflection point, or should be another inflection point in this debate.
Yeah, I mean, this is just stunning because, I mean, I think I just have to read this one part out because it you know, it made me like spit out my drink practically listening, reading this. But today there is broad acknowledgement among many public health and education experts that extended school closures did not significantly stop the spread of COVID, while the academic harms for children have been large and long lasting. This is something that many of us were arguing in March and April of 2020. I wrote something in April 2020 that basically had a paragraph that said the exact same thing. And it, at the time, the so-called public health and education experts were arguing the exact opposite. They were arguing that it was necessary to close the schools when DeSantis fought teachers' unions to open the schools. It was being promoted by the left as an experiment in child sacrifice and teacher sacrifice. You'd have dishonest headlines by the media saying teacher dies of COVID, and it would be, you know, a teacher that got COVID over the summer and died. And died like at the start of the school year, and they tried to dishonestly blame it. There was just so much, you know, the articles on the actual risk to children that defied all of the data, and this whole idea of children as being super spreaders, and that it was going to be like a nuclear bomb if we reopen schools. And at the same time saying children are resilient, you know, it's fine that we're doing Zoom learning. It's just as good as being in the classroom. All of this stuff that we were arguing about and banging, I mean, contemporaneously, many of us were saying this is one of the worst public policy decisions in history. And at the time, it was obvious that it was going to disproportionately hurt all of the, you know, low-income minority groups that the left always is saying that we have to help. All of the talk about the education gap, the achievement gap, all of this stuff was exacerbated because if you were a family of means, you could adjust it by either sending your kids to private school, or you could take the time to reinforce and teach your kids, and, you know, you're not going to have your kids fall significantly behind with reading. You could hire tutors. There are more resources that you could do to get around it. But it was always going to be the worst among, you know, lower income people without that, without all of those resources to mitigate the damaging effects, not to mention the social issues, the mental health challenges. And it's really irreparable. It's not something that we're ever going to catch up to. And what's also interesting is that even though a lot of other countries instituted strict lockdowns, some even stricter than the United States, America was unique in terms of the length of time that schools were shut. In the blue districts, there were schools that were shut down for a year. There was a year in which children did not see the inside of the classroom. And it was due to teachers' unions and Democratic politicians who are beholden to the teachers' unions. And it's an absolute scandal that this was allowed to happen. The idea that the New York Times, which fought all of this stuff, is now saying, oh, gee whiz, like now the expert consensus is it was a complete disaster. I mean, like everyone was saying this at the time that looked at the actual, and anyone with kids that saw what it was like for kids to do Zoom school knew what a complete catastrophe it was.
Zoom learning, one of the great oxymorons of all time. So Charlie, expound a little bit more on what Phil ended up with there. Why was this, there's this fanaticism around this question. Was it entirely just to serve, you know, this really powerful Democratic constituency, teachers who were afraid of COVID and or just didn't want to go back to work? They didn't have to? Or is it a broader freak out about COVID and the pandemic, or what played into this fact that you had this a really unfortunate element of American exceptionalism here, that we are crazier and more self-destructive on this than other advanced countries?
It feels bringing back all of those memories and reminding me that it's not just that Cassandra can see the truth, but is destined not to be believed, but she ends up being brutally killed at the end. It's not a great feeling to know that what's happening is absurd, and know that eventually people will say, oh, actually, he was right. And I think it's a lot of things. I think one is, as Phil described, the relationship between the Democratic Party and the teachers' unions. I think part of it is a safetyism that has crept in to our culture. I think part of it is that science, the capital S, often has nothing to do with the scientific method as we were taught it in school, but is instead manipulated to represent and resemble the opinions of the people who happen at any given moment to be in positions of authority. And that's why this is so frustrating to see. At the time, so many of the claims that were being made that were self-evidently wrong were draped in the mantle of science. The evidence was another favored phrase. Now, the science says something else. That's how they get away with it. That's how the New York Times gets away with it. That's how the people who lectured us at the time can sleep at night. Because they say, well, there's evidence, I followed it, and then I followed the next bit of evidence, and even though they're totally contradictory, what was I supposed to do? Use my common sense? Like a pleb? And I just think that we have, over the last few years, and COVID showed this, as have many other incidents, come to realize that an awful lot of our elites are not. That an awful lot of the people in power, people with authority, whether legal or moral, are mediocre at best and self-serving at worst. I don't think I've ever seen better examples of that self-serving instinct than we got during COVID. Two of them come to mind. One was teachers' unions, the people who, as Phil notes, constantly talk about education gaps and the importance of in-school learning, said, well, it won't matter if children don't go to school. Really? The teachers' unions don't think it matters if kids don't go to school? And the other one was the astonishing proposition that if I, in Florida, went to the beach for an afternoon, I was likely to wipe out whole families. But that if there was a mass protest in the name of George Floyd in the middle of a city, that was all right. We have just watched, unfortunately, as the people who for years were reflexively trusted by a majority of citizens in this country outed themselves as unfit for duty. Now, as Noah notes, we don't really want to talk about the pandemic anymore, and I do understand that. And I don't think that an election run on recriminations for decisions made during the pandemic is going to be particularly successful. Ron DeSantis found that out when he sought the Republican nomination. But the New York Times cannot be allowed to get away with this. The people who called anyone who dissented names cannot be allowed to get away with this. Those who remain in positions of power cannot be allowed to get away with this. Because the victims of this are those kids. And from what I understand, they are going to suffer the consequences, not in some temporary sense, but for a long time to come, perhaps for their whole lives. And in a society that is as obsessed as we are with systemic this and structural that, to wave our hands at it and say, oh, well, would be unacceptable and out of character.
Noah.
Yeah. So one of the things that happened early in the pandemic is a sort of tribal identity, as Charlie said, arose around your respective approaches to the pandemic, and being blasé or laissez-faire with it, or even welcoming state-level experimentation with mitigation efforts became right-wing coded. And the response to that from the left was to be maintained sort of hypervigilance to the point of being manic and even hypochondriacal. And we were treated to a ton of gaslighting during this period about schools in particular. The idea that there was no evidence for any sort of learning loss, which parents experienced immediately and began telling pollsters about and began protesting about insofar as they were capable of doing so. The acknowledgement that the hybridized model, which many conflated with openness and an open school up to and including the Biden administration, which set bizarre standards for the notion that 50%, at least one day a week, of students attending the school constituted open. This was something that was retailed at the time. And there was quite a bit of deference to the teachers' unions, who apparently remain entirely unrepentant here. One of the lines in that New York Times story features an American Federation of Teachers Union representative who said the following, quote, "It doesn't matter what is going on in the building and how much people are learning if people are getting the virus and running the potential of dying." They're still married to this narrative that there was a profound threat to teacher safety from their students. Their students were little menaces who could be out to kill them, quite literally. And there was an extortion racket associated with this. In cities and states that are of a particularly blue hue, teachers insisted upon getting access to the vaccines early enough. They insisted upon additional funding for them that would not necessarily result in their return to the classroom, but was necessary. Indeed, Rochelle Walensky said that we needed a lot more resources in order to open schools in the summer of 2020, late summer of 2020, going to the next school year. When they were sitting on $50 billion that were appropriated from the CARES Act and still didn't necessarily, somehow didn't have enough money to open schools. And indeed, I think some of that money remains unspent. Chicago teachers did, you know, quasi strikes, illegal strikes in some cases. Like there was a real commitment to this notion that there was a conspiracy on to have teachers exposed unduly to harms that, you know, were basically OSHA violations, that they were really being put at risk here for the benefit of some sort of a political agenda. And this went on for years. And now they're trying to run away from it, as they probably should. And the problem that, as Charlie says, we should have some sort of a reckoning here. Society should have a reckoning. But we will not. The opportunity for that was in the 2022 midterms. 2021 off-year elections were a COVID year. And Republicans performed spectacularly well, almost taking the governor's mansion in New Jersey, but taking a lot of legislative seats, taking the governor's mansion in Virginia. And if that had been the theme upon which Republicans campaigned in 2022, I suspect they would have done spectacularly well, because there was a real appetite for among voters across the political spectrum for a critical retrospective on what we did in the pandemic.
It also helped because there's more proximity. You know, we're closer to the pandemic.
It was still with us in many places. And indeed, in 2023,
Youngkin was slammed for being against masking with kids.
Masking was still a thing last year. They were trying to bring it back when we had a mild resurgence of this virus. The outlook that had captured the left was still very prevalent in 2022. But that is not what Republicans campaigned on. It's not what they want, the face they wanted to present to voters, a return to normalcy. They didn't want a return to normalcy. Part of our big political problem here is that voters on both sides of the spectrum regard normal, whatever that's defined as, status quo ante, as unacceptable, as having failed a lot of people, more than we should accept. And there's still a profound appetite for normalcy in this electorate that neither political party seems inclined to sate or satisfy. But it is desirable, at least, to see the New York Times perform, is just even a matter of throat clearing, a retrospective on a lot of the things that their constituents still believe were desirable approaches to mitigating the worst effects of the pandemic, if only to establish the record so that we never, ever have to experience it again.
So, Phil, ask a question to you. This piece is part of a turning of the worm such that when the history books are written, the COVID fanatics will be more the villain than folks like Ron DeSantis.
Well, I think that no, because you already see that the way that they're trying to reframe history, like Randy Weingarten, she's been saying that it was the teachers' unions that were fighting to open schools. And I think that, you know, because they control the media and the expert class that they're going to argue, they bravely tried to reopen schools, but the Republicans refused to fund reasonable safety measures.
Charlie?
I think that this is going to depend on what happens in our politics over the next few years. Even if the topic is not one people want to talk about, if, oddly enough, I think if Trump wins, if the left cracks up, if there is some shift in the public's attitude more broadly toward the sort of people who were associated with that fanaticism, I think maybe in 20 years we will look back and say, yes, they paid a price for it. If that doesn't happen, no.
I do think that the COVID fanatics will be looked back upon as the people who were on the wrong side of this debate. And I think the evidence is everywhere. In fact, this topic that we're discussing right now is evidence of it. I don't think we would get this kind of what I said is throat clearing, a perfunctory exercise, but nevertheless valuable, is an acknowledgement of the mistakes that were made. And then you have to say to yourself, well, who made those mistakes? And there's a really very clear dividing line. There is not sort of an ambiguous set of forces here where we can say, well, you know, the lines are kind of blurry. It was a very big, bright dividing line between right and left very early on in the pandemic and throughout the pandemic as to what outlook. In fact, I think that's part of why we're having this discussion in the first place. What outlooks were right-wing coded and what outlooks were left-wing coded? And there's a very clear association as when it comes to pandemic policy about based on your personal politics. So yeah, I think that ultimately, excessive mitigation measures will be associated with the left, and excessive mitigation measures will be also associated with bad outcomes for not just students, but American society more broadly.
So I do think history will turn on this. I just think it will take a very, very long time. And by the way, it wasn't the most consequential or destructive thing, but looking back, it was totally insane. The fanaticism, to use that word again, around getting professional athletes vaccinated. These are like the fittest people on earth, you know, and if Aaron Rodgers didn't want to take the vaccine, or that tennis player, what is his name, Djokovic or whatever, that it was so insistent, they're made out to be villains and selfish and on the verge of infecting all sorts of other professional athletes that they didn't get vaccinated. It was just crazy. It was just flat out.
Can I also add, though, that I think it would be a mistake to dwell on that, because it was kind of ambiguous when we didn't know whether or not this vaccine behaved like other vaccines insofar as it would interrupt transmission rates. I mean, there was genuinely nobody actually knew that wouldn't do that just like every other vaccine. We knew from the second we had to start doing homeschooling that this wasn't working out. We knew it. And we shouldn't confuse that.
The vaccine obsession went, in this sense, and I'm pro-vaccine in general, but it went way beyond. Like Marjorie Taylor Greene was kicked off Twitter for pointing out the vaccine wasn't, in part, kicked off Twitter for pointing out the vaccine wasn't stopping transmission when it was clear at that point it wasn't. But they still kept on this line.
Yeah. Also, I'm pro-vaccine too, insofar as the vaccine saved people's lives when they contracted COVID. But if it is the case, as you say, Noah, that we didn't know, then you don't mandate it. That seems to me obvious. And those people tried. They tried using rules in laws and authorities that they didn't have. Biden had to be rebuked by the Supreme Court for it. As someone who needs, and I think needs is the right word, to travel to England relatively frequently so I can see my family or to have them come over here, it was impossible to do so without a vaccine. Now, I went and got it because I wanted to protect myself. But I think we went way overboard in what we demanded of people, given that we didn't know that information. That's in and of itself a problem.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let me pause, do a quick plug for NR Plus, digital subscription service at nationalreview.com, your way around a metered paywall, your way. If you sign up and log in and see about 90% fewer ads your way, floats your boat. And if you want to comment on articles and blog posts and get invited to exclusive events and calls with our writers, editors, and other conservative figures is a great deal all around. And more importantly, a really valuable way to support our journalism. So if you're not already a member, please consider joining tens of thousands of your fellow National Review readers as a member of NR Plus today, tomorrow, or the day after, or if you really have to procrastinate, maybe even the day after that. So, Charlie, we have lots of action on the Trump legal fronts happening in multiple jurisdictions. Late last week, we had this Fannie Willis disqualification ruling, or a very Solomonic ruling from this judge saying that Fannie Willis can stay on the case, but Nathan Wade, the special prosecutor with whom she was having an affair, had to go, and he has duly gone. But this is a bit of a Pyrrhic victory for Fannie Willis, because this is as excoriating a decision as you could get that would leave her on the case. The judge spoke of this odor of deception, which was a nice way of saying that Willis and Wade just flat out lied. You know, the officers of the court just lying about when the affair started. And it wasn't just a private matter, you know, having to do with personal embarrassment. It implicated one of the key questions in the whole hearing, which is whether this was a way to enrich someone she was having a relationship with. And it was obvious that the relationship started before she hired her, but she stays on the case, but very much as a wounded duck.
Donald Trump, as ever, is fortunate in his opponents. If he ever comes up against someone who is cleaner than clean and represents all the best of our ideals, he will be in trouble. But that doesn't seem to happen. Perhaps this is related to our discussion in the previous segment about the state of our elites. I've seen some people respond to the judge's ruling by saying, aha, now Donald Trump will feel the full fury of an angry Fannie Willis. Is that really the way you want the American justice system to run? I think the guy who said that is Bradley Moss on Twitter. Seems to be a lawyer, seems to be invited on television and the radio fairly often to give his advice. That's how we want to treat people, is it? We want to make our judicial system contingent upon the anger of a prosecutor who was actually discovered doing something wrong. We want it to be vengeful and retaliatory. I don't. I think there's all together too much of this going around. I'm, of course, not an expert in bonds or in sentencing guidelines, but I'm also seeing a great deal of glee about the extraordinary amount of money that Donald Trump has been ordered to pay in his civil case, and the fact that he's struggling to raise the funds. It seems to thrill people, as if that's the purpose of the litigation. Yeah, rather
and it thrills Letitia James. She's posting on Twitter about it, updating the number, which grows by, I think, as Andy McCarthy points out, because of interest, grows at $112,000 a day.
Right. She, of course, ran promising to find something to go after Trump for, then found it and is now boasting about having done it. I'm sorry, I don't care what you think about Donald Trump. Again, let's separate this out. This is unseemly, and it diminishes faith in our system. Now, I know what others are going to say. They're going to say, and it helps Trump. And I think that's probably true.
So you think it helps him in a general? It obviously helped him.
Yeah.
In a
wow. I don't think it helps him more than if it had never happened. But I think mm-hmm. given that these cases have been brought, the way that the people involved in them have behaved mm-hmm. diminishes how much it hurts Trump. Mm-hmm. I think that if Fannie Willis were the hypothetical upstanding prosecutor that I described, this case would hurt Trump a lot more. I think if Letitia James didn't behave in the way she behaves, that case would hurt Trump a lot more. Mm-hmm. I think that if Morning Joe were not full of prosecutors and former prosecutors yucking it up about how funny it is that Trump has to pay this much money or can't borrow to cover it or can't post all of that, I think that hurts them because it makes it look political. And you know, maybe it is political. That's the criticism against it. But there's always a line that you can and should be able to draw in a free country between what is political and what is necessary. Sometimes things that are necessary have a political consequence. The Hillary Clinton investigation had political consequences. That doesn't mean it was unjustified. But if the people, I'm not talking about Congress here because Congress is always going to be political. But if the people who were in charge of investigating Hillary had been on television every day laughing about it, if the Twitter accounts of the team had been tracking her polling in Wisconsin, dropping by the day, for example, I think people would have said, hold on a minute, what is it that we're doing here? And I think Trump is so lucky in that the people who are going after him, often with cause, because he does stuff that other Republicans wouldn't. This idea that whatever candidate Republicans choose, that the machine will come in and roll them into court, that's just not true. I mean, Ron DeSantis, for example, just hasn't done the things.
Yeah. What are they going to get Ron DeSantis on? Being boring, you know?
Well, he didn't sleep with Stormy Daniels. He mm-hmm. didn't run a business potentially fraudulently, although I think that case is weak. He didn't try and steal the 2020 election. He didn't make that speech on January 6th. So we can forget all of that. But Trump is fortunate because he's done a lot of the things, or at least he's plausibly done a lot of the things that he's been hauled into court for. And then the people who are in charge of it are idiots. And they're going to really undermine their own position by the end of this.
So Noah, the Trump, on the posting the bond, maybe gets lucky and he sells Truth Social and time to produce the money. But otherwise, I mean, he's staring down the barrel of a gun here, where Letitia James could block his bank accounts or put liens on buildings or conceivably even seize buildings, which is a possibility that she has discussed, very pleased with herself in interviews.
Yeah, I think she actually means it, which is insofar as her behavior, sordid as it is suggestive of her intentions. I think she actually would seek to take Trump's assets if he can't post what he wants to post here in order to try to appeal this verdict. I think the politics of this are really rather fascinating, if only insofar as the fact we don't have anything to judge it against. This is all uncharted waters for us, so there really are no wrong answers, which makes it hard to evaluate, but we do have some data.
There are wrong answers, we just don't know them yet.
We don't know them yet.
And we're probably given some of them ourselves already.
I mean, I'm no lawyer, but it seems likely to me that Fannie Willis's case is can't be proven to the satisfaction of a jury now if she's the one prosecuting it, and she seems intent on making herself the prosecutor of it. Likewise, we follow the Manhattan prosecution, the Alvin Bragg indictment, at a granular level, and so we know that this is a really novel theory of the case, that they spun out one transaction into 34 felony counts, that it's jurisdictionally a little weird, and all that stuff renders us skeptical of it. But that's not where voters are at. Most voters, according to a Reuters Ipsos poll that was published by Politico yesterday, think Trump is guilty of the underlying charges, and moreover, that something like 44% of independents say that it would have, or 36% of independents say that would make them less likely to support Trump if he was convicted on even one of these charges. Now, I'm not sure whether that's a rationalization or not, and they'll be able to convince themselves otherwise by November. I wouldn't put it past voters generally. But one of the things you used to hear about Donald Trump from persuadable voters, whether they meant it or not, they said it, which is that, you know, this guy is independently wealthy. He's uncorruptible in that sense. Cannot be bought. He certainly can be bought now. In fact, he's soliciting himself to just about anybody who will help him put up this what he owes to appeal this case. And that level of desperation could have an impact on his appeal, the air about him that he's cultivated. I'm not sure how it will manifest, but I would be surprised if it helped him beyond his Republican base, who genuinely does believe that he's being persecuted. There are certainly Republican leaners who will say he's being persecuted. But people have been saying to pollsters now, a majority have been saying to pollsters for a long time, that a conviction would make them less likely to support Donald Trump, and that all of his legal problems sort of combine into one amorphous blob of legal trouble hanging over Donald Trump like the sword of Damocles. I really do think that'll have a negative effect on his appeal. I don't think it helps him more than it hurts him. And whether it's fair or not is independent from the political outcome that obviously Democrats and politically motivated prosecutors have been trying to seek. Is it fair? Depends on the case. Most of the time you can say no. But that doesn't necessarily mean it won't work. I think we're seeing evidence that it is working.
Yeah, so Phil, there's a natural tendency on part of the public in these cases. One, they assume whoever's accused of something or being investigated is guilty, usually. And then they also assume that whoever's launching or conducting the investigation is doing it for political reasons. So you ask this question in polling, and it's pretty evenly divided. I think maybe it tilts a little bit against Trump, at least in some of these cases now. But anything that discredits the investigators or the prosecutors like Fannie Willis helps Trump at least fight to a draw on this question.
Well, just looking at some of the YouGov polling, this was taken before a lot of the Fannie Willis revelations, so grain of salt. But what you see is on the question of is it sort of fair or unfair, basically it's what you expect. Republicans overwhelmingly think that Trump's being prosecuted unfairly. But it ranges, basically roughly a third of people think that the overall public thinks that he is being prosecuted or unfairly. So basically it's, among all adults, it's like 34, 35, depending on the case. But if you look at all U.S. adults, anywhere from 40 to 46%, depending on the case, think that he's been prosecuted fairly. And if you look at Biden's Real Clear Politics average, it's around 45%. So it seems to me that how many people who think that Trump's being fairly prosecuted, who think he should be found guilty, are currently toss-up voters and waiting to figure out what the conviction is. I don't know if the question of does this make you more or less likely to vote for Trump is really helpful, because one, I think that people are inclined to just answer that as, do you think Trump should get convicted or not? I don't think many people are thinking, regardless what I think about this, in a theoretical alternate universe of whether he's convicted or not, how would that affect my vote? And also, people don't know. They can't really predict. It depends how he's convicted, how the trial plays. I think that people don't really get into a lot of the details. The question is that, as far as I see it, is that I think where it hurts Trump is just not in the underlying details or revelations about this is what he did or he's in court. I just think a lot of that sort of baked in. I think it's just the general idea of a voter who's on the fence thinking, you know what, I don't want to go back to four more years of drama if Trump is reelected. I think that that overall sense that it was just constant chaos and drama and all that stuff, people don't even care like what the details are. They just know that it was just always something with Trump. And so I think that could kind of weigh on him in you know, totally, you know, in a more abstract way, as opposed to necessarily the specific convictions.
All right, so let's do an exit question, checking in on everyone's percentage odds that Donald Trump wins in November. Just let's see if there have been any changes here. Charlie Cook, percentage odds that Donald Trump wins in November.
What was I last time, 48, 52?
I thought it was 48.
I think I'm at 48, 52.
So sorry, that's 48 Trump, 52 Biden?
Correct.
Okay. Noah.
Last time you asked this, which I think was last week, I was at 45%. I'm still at 45%, and I'm going to say that until the summer, when I think the polling landscape will be really reflective of what we are going to see in November. Right now, I don't think enough people are tuned in for us to know one way or the other, so just be fishing. So 45% for me still.
Phil, we have a couple below water answers for Trump.
Okay, so I'm going to stick with my previous, which was 49-49, and giving 2% chance to somehow it'll be somebody other than either Trump or Biden.
Yeah, okay. I remember, Noah, last time I asked, I attributed Phil's answer to you. I misremembered, but I knew someone had some non-Trump, non-Biden percentage. I don't think that's crazy to have that 2% in there, given especially the possibility that poor Joe Biden, something might happen to him before November. I'm moving my number. We should have like a chime, some sort of special chime. Sarah, can we work on that when someone's changed their percentage? I'll do it. Ding, 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 ding. I'm up to 52. I was playing with the idea to going to 52 from 50 the last time I asked this, but I went with Noah's caution. Let's wait for a little more time to pass, get more information. But Henry Olson, who was on an NR Plus call, another reason you should sign up for NR Plus, so you can listen in on conversations with great folks like Henry Olson, but he's at 55 for Trump. So that moved me, convinced me to go with my instinct and go up to 52 for Trump. So there we have it. What do we have? 48, 45, 49, 52. So with that, let's hit a few other things before we go. Phil, you have invested, this is a key investment, in an old DVD player.
Yeah, well, it's not old. You can get
cheap, very cheap
$30 DVD players on Amazon. I was able to search around and find one that was not manufactured in China. But basically, I'm just sort of sick of flipping around the streaming services with nothing to watch when I have an extensive collection of DVDs that are gathering dust, many films that I haven't watched in a number of years that I'd much rather watch than whatever schlock they put on Netflix. I don't know if the statistics on the number of movies prior to 1970 that Netflix has is sort of
just, you know, very ridiculously low. And I kind of feel like I'm kind of convinced that the small town video store where I grew up has a had a larger selection of actually legitimate movies than Netflix, which just present, you know, they had all of the things lined up like at a bookstore, right? So they're all squeezed together. Netflix makes the picture some big. Sometimes I've noticed now Netflix will have the same movie, but they'll put different cover art on the movie, so it makes it seem like it's a different movie, but it actually.
So are you with me and tend not to like movies made before 1970, with some exception for real classics?
Well, 1970s was a great decade for movies, and some for nostalgia purposes. I like some 80s movies, but I do love myself classic movies, and you know, Netflix's idea of a classic is, you know, Jurassic Park, which, you know, as a teenager, I loved it. But, you know, when I think of a classic, I think of, you know, like, Myrna Loy, William Powell movie, not like some movie I saw as a teenager.
Noah, you had a cultural mashup going on over the weekend.
Yes, we invite, it's become something of a tradition that we invite some family friends from my kids' preschool era JCC, who we've kept in touch with, over for St. Patrick's Day. And we do the St. Patrick's Day Fair, and I am the most Irish person in that contingent. It's a lot of Puerto Ricans and Paraguayans and Jews, and I'm, you know, sort of halvesies. And I grew up in with my Irish Catholic mother, you know, celebrating St. Patrick's Day as traditionally as you possibly can, with boiled everything, boiled cabbage, boiled potatoes, boiled corned beef. And we still kind of do that. My wife makes delicious shepherd's pie, but we still have the corned beef and the cabbage. But there's a nice little Jewish element to it, because now our friends bring over like rye bread. And you can't help but throw the corned beef with a little bit of mustard on the rye bread, and then it becomes something much more delicious than boiled cabbage and corned beef. We're amending tradition a little bit for the sake of flavor and right. Really reaping the rewards.
So curious, do you brine your own corned beef?
No.
You have to do
absolutely
that.
Not.
You have to do it. You
it's
can't
gotta
buy
be
the store
cultural
brand.
Appropriation.
I'm telling you, I'll send you a recipe. You've got to.
I'm sure Phil, for everybody, actually has improved my cooking quite a bit by giving me a tuna fish recipe that includes more than just mayonnaise and celery. Mm-hmm. And
so
I really appreciate his tuna.
Is brining more involved than just like soaking it in brine?
No, it is. You have to just get a whole brisket and put it in this solution.
Of course, it always involves whatever it is with you involves a whole brisket. Yeah,
they do sell them at Costco for a good price, but you basically yes have to put it in a tub of water with salt and various other spices and keep it in for a week.
But this, it should be known that this is very heterodox, because if you're doing this in truly Celtic fashion, you may be allowed a little salt, but otherwise. Flavor is kind of forbidden. You just got to boil the thing and eat it.
Where is MBD when we need him? We need him to decide this issue. So, Charlie, your parents visit.
Absolutely. They came over for 4 or 5 days. In fact, before they came down to Florida to see us, they went to see some parts of the U.S. they hadn't seen. So they saw Mount Vernon and went to Annapolis, saw the spot on which George Washington resigned his commission. And they went down to Williamsburg in Virginia. And then they came down to see us and hang out with the grandkids. And I went to Miami yesterday for NRI. They flew back to England. So we went to the airport together, went in our different directions. It was a great trip.
Awesome. So I spent some quality time yesterday with the oral surgeon. I had an implant. And I oftentimes on Thanksgiving, when we ask what we're grateful for, I'll say modern dentistry. So for the hour in this chair and the day afterwards, I wasn't that grateful, because this, you know, drilling when you have a cavity is kind of annoying, but drilling for an implant, it's like a jackhammer on your jaw. But I'm already feeling better, and I'm still grateful for modern dentistry. With that, it's time for our editor's picks. Noah, what's your pick?
apposite to the topic that we were discussing earlier, but it's about a week old. It's Jack Butler's Don't Selectively Remember the Lessons of COVID, where he goes through quite a bit of the assumptions that guided public health policy over the course of that event and the sort of effort to bury the memory of what didn't work and who was prescient in saying that our society-wide approaches to the mitigation of this disease were doing more harm than the disease itself. He goes through it admirably. It's an important piece to read, and I recommend you do so.
Phil, what's your pick?
I'd like to just pick the suite of coverage that Jim Garrity is doing from Ukraine. He's on the scene there now. So I've missed talking to him about Jets free agency, but it's great to have him over there and just pretty much every day he's just posting something that's this must reading. So I would just point everyone just go over to his author page and just you know, read some of his dispatches from Ukraine.
Charlie.
I'm going to pick Noah's piece, Is Long COVID Real? I have long been a skeptic. I'm a long skeptic of long COVID. I have thought for a while this is probably psychological. And Noah looks into some studies that suggest that, yep, it's probably psychological. That, by the way, is its own problem. Hypochondria yields results that to the sufferer feel real, but that doesn't mean that it is a disease, and it seems more than likely, given the evidence we have, that it's not.
So my pick is Dominic Pino's contribution to our webathon, where he highlights all our work that is bending against the winds on the right, where the market is not considered such a excellent thing anymore, but NR, including Dominic himself, have stood true to the idea that the markets make everyone in this country wealthier. That's it for us. You've been listening to a National View podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of National View Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Noah. Thank you, Phil. Thanks to Maiden, and thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors, and we'll see you next time.